Welcome to Smart Talk. I'm Scott Lamar, broadcasting from my home studio. Coming up later in the program, monuments to a Confederate general that is dividing Americans today. But up front, contact tracing was seen as one of the keys to slowing the spread of the coronavirus. However, Pennsylvania doesn't have enough contact tracers, and they're not getting cooperation from many who they contact. All the while, the COVID-19 virus is surging as more people are testing positive, are being hospitalized, and dying from the virus. What went wrong, and can contact tracing be an effective tool in fighting the spread of the virus? Joining us is Penn Live investigative reporter Wallace McKelvey, who recently wrote extensively about contact tracing. Wallace McKelvey, welcome to the program.
Good morning, Scott.
If you have a question or a comment, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. You can leave a question or a comment on Twitter. We're at SmartTalkWITF. Again, that phone number, 1-800-729-7532. Wallace, just for context sake, for those who may not be familiar, what is contact tracing?
So contact tracing is one of the fundamentals of public health. Like, you can go all the way back to the Black Death in the Middle Ages and find examples of contact tracing. They didn't call it that back then, but essentially the fundamentals are the same. What you do is you talk to someone, you have a, interview them, kind of like what you're doing to me right now. Someone who's been sick, you ask them, where have you been? If you know who you were around, so perhaps the people in your family, people in the workplace, people at church, wherever, you ask them a series of questions to find out who they may have exposed in the immediate period of time before they got sick. And then the contact tracing, where that the tracing part comes in, you actually follow those leads. You are investigating to see, okay, of for argument's sake, 20 people that this sick person was in contact with, maybe five of them are experiencing symptoms. And then you repeat the process down the line. So you take those five people, and then you ask them, well, where did you go? Who were you in contact with? And this is a way of getting ahead of the virus. This is a way of figuring out how far it has spread, and also giving people advance warning. Perhaps people who are not currently sick, because we know the incubation period of coronavirus, for example, can be up to 14 days, reaching out to these contacts prior to the onset of symptoms can give them a heads up to say, hey, you should probably get tested. You should probably also isolate so you avoid inadvertently infecting other people.
It was, as I mentioned in the introduction, considered one of the keys to slowing down the spread. But from your reports and interviews that I've done as well, it has not been as successful as hoped. Why not?
Well, here's the thing. In an ideal world, it actually is very successful. There have been examples, even examples of like highly stigmatized diseases like AIDS. Contact tracing has been effective. It's effective in preventing the spread of tuberculosis. That is ongoing. Here, the biggest problem right now seems to be staffing. Back in August, Health Secretary Rachel Levine said that in order to get ahead of the anticipated surge in the fall, which it's now the fall and we are seeing that surge, she had hoped to have 4,500 contact tracers working statewide, tracking down the course of the disease. The most recent numbers that we got from the Department of Health put the number of tracers at 1,672, which is a pretty far distance away from 4,500. That is one part of this story is the lack of staffing. That inhibits the ability to get ahead of the disease and make these contacts and figure out where the disease is being spread. The other part of it is the cooperation. What we're also finding is that, in part because of the complex, political nature of the world that we're in, where even the president is casting doubt on mitigation efforts, a lot of people are not cooperating when they do get the call from a contact tracer. There's a lot of mistrust, and that in some ways is understandable. An epidemiologist that I spoke to for a story the other week on PennLive.com said, nobody is sitting in their house hoping they can share their private lives over the phone with a stranger. It is understandable to some degree when someone's asking you these invasive questions that you may not feel comfortable answering them. You may not want to say, I infected, possibly 50 people at my church. I might have infected 20 people at my workplace. That there's a certain level of shame that is inherent in kind of answering these questions. And then when you pile on top of that the increasing environment of mistrust in this country around anything to do with COVID-19, that leads a certain kind of population to say, number one, they may not answer the call at all. And when they do answer the call, they might be very hesitant to share the names of people that they interacted with or the businesses that they went to during that 14-day window where they were maybe not symptomatic, but possibly spreading the disease.
Something you mentioned, Wallace, in your stories, when you said, when you just suggested that there are a lot of people who may not answer the call at all. Earlier on in the pandemic, there were volunteers here in central Pennsylvania. Medical students from Penn State Hershey were volunteering to be contact tracers, and they seem to have a better success rate than those that are actually being paid now from the state. What's the difference?
Yeah, that was a really interesting kind of anecdotal element to that story that I kind of stumbled upon in the process of reporting. And the difference there, and it's a little complicated. The person who was leading that program was hesitant to beat up on the state too much because there are also factors that made that program unique. So when you're talking about the Penn State program, one thing that you're dealing with is recognition. Penn State is such a massive institution in Pennsylvania. I don't need to tell you that. That when that shows up on your caller ID, you're probably more likely to pick up the phone and at least have that initial engagement with that person. Whereas with a lot of the state contact tracers, when they call you, odds are it either shows up as an unknown number. And I don't know about you, but when I get a call, I get lots and lots of junk calls on my phone now, even my cell phone. I don't pick up if I don't recognize the number.
If there's not
a very obvious caller ID.
Yep, I never
and
do.
Then, go on.
No, I was going to say, I agree with you. I never pick up when I see a number I don't recognize.
Yeah, and the state contact tracers, they either show up as no ID or they show up as Commonwealth of Pennsylvania. And, that's so vague that, it could be a debt collector calling you. So, again, if it says Commonwealth of Pennsylvania, there's a certain subset of people who will not answer the phone for that. The other thing that made the Penn State model really unique is these are medical students. And you have to remember, at the time when this program was really in its prime, so it ran from March of this year, which was very early in the disease's spread, perhaps even before the level of mistrust reached where it is now. It ran from March through September. And That happened to coincide with a period of time where many of these med students were not doing much. Most of them didn't have classes, so they had a lot of time on their hands. And time and persistence, it turns out, is the key to really good contact tracing, because even in the best of times, even with cooperative patients, it takes a lot of effort to reach them. You have to call them at different times of day, different days of the week, and you have to be able to set aside the time to actually kind of talk them through it. It's a process, like you experience, like I experience as a journalist. Sometimes when you're talking to someone, you kind of have to coax them along. You have to. There's a warm up period. You're really from a point of not having any familiarity with this person whatsoever. You're trying to build up trust, and then you're trying to kind of talk them through the motions of what they did for the last 2 weeks. And these med students were uniquely positioned because they had the ability to call back the same person over and over and over and over again. They also had the ability to spend some real time with each person that they called. Whereas the state contact tracers are in a position now where we are, you have to keep this in context. We are seeing 8,000 or more new positive cases every day. Every 24 hours, potentially 8,000 new COVID-19 positive cases. Only roughly 1,700 contact tracers. So there's a very clear deficit there. Back in when this program was running in the spring, the summer, and through September, we were not seeing nearly that level of caseload, And so these students, they had the time to kind of to build into these interviews, to make the calls repeatedly. And they had the advantage of being associated with Penn State. The people they were calling had already a kind of natural connection to them.
Well, Penn State, the volunteer program, had some success, as well as like Lancaster General Health Group as well, because same reason, that many people recognized the caller ID where the state. Do we have any idea, in your reporting, did you find out what percentage breakdown the volunteers, maybe Lancaster General, have had compared to contact tracers for the state?
Yeah, they were incredibly successful. So Lancaster General, they reported a 65% response rate. And over roughly the same period, the Department of Health saw 16%. That is a very, very, like, vastly different response rate. Now, again, we're comparing apples to oranges for Penn State, but over the summer, Penn State was reaching something close to 90% of all of the people that they were assigned to call. And even back then, the Department of Health was not seeing that level of numbers. Another thing that kind of makes the Penn State model different is the people who are running it invested a lot of time. So, I talked to Kara Exton, the epidemiologist who was involved in that program. And they took the time to tailor their script. So when a contact tracer calls you, they're looking for a certain set of information from you, as I outlined at the top of the hour. But they have some flexibility in how they ask those questions, the order in which they ask those questions. And every interview is a little different. So what they did at Penn State is they were able to experiment with kind of figuring out how different messages could work on different people and which messages might work the best. Again, they had the advantage. They weren't doing this at the height of the pandemic, but they also had the advantage of so much expertise involved in the behind the scenes of that program. They could do a lot of this work. The one thing, though, is we're at the point now where it should be all hands on deck. And I do think that it's possible that we could learn a great deal from how Penn State handled this, even with all of their advantages. And we perhaps should be trying to expand and replicate that model. Because the another part of the story is because of the short staffing, even just, you know, kind of doing the basic work of making that initial phone call, we can't do it. Right now, the Department of Health is having to triage, which is prioritizing which specific cases need to be called first. And the way that works right now, and again, reminding you, 8,000 cases per day, 1,700 contact tracers statewide, and of those, 150 case investigators who make the initial phone call. That is a very, very, very small number. And the Department of Health, they say they're trying to bolster that program, but it's difficult. And so right now they're in a position where they're focusing on cases out of nursing homes and other congregate centers that are likely to lead to more spread. They're also focusing on individuals who perhaps are at the most vulnerable of a severe illness or death. And so even on the Department of Health side, they're only reaching 25% of new positive cases within the first 24 hours. That's a very low number, incredibly low number. And the reason that's important is contact tracers, they need to reach these patients as early as possible. Because in dealing with coronavirus mitigation, you know, every day counts. Remember that, you know, as you know, there's a long incubation period during which each of these patients could be infecting, whether they know it or not, even more people. And the system itself, it has a whole bunch of delays built into it. I've also done a lot of reporting on testing, and there are delays in testing. So you have to factor in the time between someone saying, I might have been exposed to coronavirus, to the point where, maybe I might be feeling a little sick today, I should go get tested. Then you factor in the time it takes to get tested, because sometimes people aren't able to get in to get tested right away. Then you factor in the time it takes to get the results of that test back to you, which again might take 3 to 4 or possibly even longer days. And then you factor in, okay, now you have a positive result. How long does it take for a case investigator to call you to begin the contact tracing process? And each step of the way is adding more time that you could be infecting other people. So it's really important that we're reaching out to people and starting the contact tracing process sooner. Unfortunately, because of staffing issues, because of funding issues, and because of the increasing reticence of people to cooperate with contact tracers, that time scale is getting pushed back further and further and further. And the Department of Health is increasingly having to prioritize and say, well, we're just not going to call these people because we don't have the staff to do it.
We're going to take some listener questions in just a moment. You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. Welcome back to Smart Talk. Our guest during this portion of the program is Penn Live investigative reporter Wallace McKelvey. Recently wrote extensively about contact tracing and how the state hasn't been as successful at contact tracing with the coronavirus as, say, a volunteer program with Penn State Hershey, also Lancaster General, some of the health groups around the state where caller ID, people are familiar with the caller ID, with some of these people that are calling, some of these groups that are calling. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. On Twitter, we are @smarttalk. WITF. Again, the phone number, 1-800-729-7532. Wallace, you touched on, you kind of anticipated my next question, but just wanted to ask this question to address it specifically. It sounds as if, because we have had this surge of cases here in Pennsylvania and across the country, that contact tracing has been less effective because there are just too many people to contact. Is that an accurate way to describe that?
Yes, but with a caveat. So Michael Huff, who is the director of contact tracing for the state, has made it very clear, you know, in his public statements that, you know, even with all of these problems, even with the delays, even with the lack of bandwidth to reach out to people, there are no plans to stop contact tracing because it is incredibly effective even when it has these problems. You know, reaching out to someone to find out who they've been in contact with is one of the most effective responses we have to any infectious disease. And, you know, they don't plan on stopping this at all. And for good reason. You know, you think about it, the incubation period is 14 days. If they can reach someone within even within that 14-day window, they're still potentially warding off, who knows how many potential new infections. So if they're able to do that, even just warding off one additional infection, that has a multiplier effect, because that one person could also be infecting a dozen or more other people. Now, you know, I'm kind of extrapolating a little too far out here. You know, we're getting into hypotheticals, but there is the one way to think about this. There's a concept in epidemiology called the R-naught. Now, at this point, I think probably a lot of people are familiar with this, but that's a ratio that measures, you know, how much the average patient, how many people the average coronavirus patient will infect beyond themselves. When that figure dips below one, it's a sign that the disease is waning. It's a sign that we're doing a good job and that we're preventing the spread. Right now, Pennsylvania's R-naught is hitting like 1.3 and climbing. So that is not a good sign. It's a sign that people are infecting other people, and that it is, you know, we don't have our arms around this virus right now.
Let me interrupt for just 1 second.
Contact tracing specifically. Oh, sorry.
Go ahead. No, I wanted to, because we only have a few minutes left, I want to make sure I get a couple of listener questions.
Sure.
And Randall asked, and Randall has several questions, but I want to kind of narrow down a couple he has here that could make a lot of sense. Wants to know, why doesn't the state publish summary statistics on contact tracing the way it does for cases, deaths, and tests? For example, percentage of COVID positive cases who have provided contact information, percentage of contacts who have been reached and warmed by a contact tracer, percentage of those contacted who have been tested, percentage tested who tested contacts or tested positive. The point that Randa was making there is a good one, that every day we see those news releases come out from the Department of Health on the number of positives, number of deaths, number of hospitalizations. If we publicize contact tracing, wouldn't it help for more people to be more cooperative?
The short answer is the state does publish that information, but they do it on a weekly basis. They don't do it in the daily press releases. They already do publish that information. It just may not be well publicized.
Well, it probably isn't. Allison asks, I've been keeping my eyes open for contact tracer jobs, but they seem to have disappeared. Are Pennsylvania healthcare organizations still hiring? I'm available and skilled. Whom do I contact?
Unfortunately, because the way the system is set up, it's very spread out, It's like a lot of our coronavirus response, quite frankly, and this extends to testing as well. You know, in the rush to get things up to speed, it created a kind of patchwork system. I would suggest for her case specifically, she might want to reach out directly to some hospital systems that are already doing this work. So, for example, Lancaster General, she might want to reach out to them directly and see if she can, if they have any openings for her. You know, the other thing is we're dealing with limited funding here. You know, the federal government has not passed any additional aid for the states, at least not so far, not since the initial round. And that is another limiting factor here. Also, the Pennsylvania legislature has not made more money available for coronavirus response yet. So there's limited funding available to fund contact tracing and everything else. And that, again, is another limiting factor for the amount of staff that can be hired.
Got another email from a former doctor who said that he contacted the Department of Health, heard back once, but never heard anything again. So just throwing that in there. Final question. The app that the state has put out, I'm part of that app. I want to just take a look here and see what the latest numbers are as far as people who are on the app, COVID Alert PA. And once my phone would cooperate. Well, anyway, what I want to ask is how important is that app?
Yeah. The one way to think about this app, the COVID Alert PA, is in the absence of actual human contact tracers, this app is kind of the next best thing. And it has the advantage where it passively absorbs everywhere you go. You know, so you go to Rite Aid, for example, you know, and you pass someone and they happen to be, it turns out they're COVID positive and they have the app. This app will let you know that you were in proximity to someone who was positive, all anonymously. But whereas if that person was called by a human contact tracer, they don't know who they were in close contact with if they didn't actually know the person. The app itself, though, is somewhat limited because it's an opt-in. It's a voluntary thing. And the last I checked earlier this week, they had they were pushing like 600,000 users.
Yeah, that's what it is.
You have to put that number in context. Pennsylvania has a population of 12.8 million. And only, you know, roughly 600,000 Pennsylvanians have the app. So unfortunately, that's not a lot of people. And so it limits the effectiveness of that app.
Hmm. Penn Live investigative reporter Wallace McKelvey, some great work here, Wallace. But to kind of summarize, what we need here in this state is more contact tracers, more cooperation, and more money. Does that pretty well sum it up?
Yeah, it does. And also, you know, we really need to consider programs like the Penn State model, where, you know, one way in the absence of money to expand contact tracing is to try to recruit more volunteer contact tracers.
Tomorrow, by the way, we will be answering more of your coronavirus questions. Wallace McKelvey of PennLive.com. Hey, Wallace, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you for having me, and be well.
You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. Civil War buffs may know the name Nathan Bedford Forrest as a general in the Confederate Army who became legendary in the South for his daring raids on Union troops in the Western Theater of the War. Forrest was also the first Grand Wizard of the Ku Klux Klan. More than 150 years later, monuments to Forrest are dividing communities today. Lancaster native Connor Town O'Neill stumbled upon Forrest and learned how a long-dead Confederate is a major source of contention in an era when the nation is having a reckoning with race. His new book describes that journey. It's called Down Along with That Devil's Bones, A Reckoning with Monuments, Memory, and the Legacy of White Supremacy. Connor Town O'Neill, welcome to the program.
Hey, Scott. Good to be with you.
If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. on Twitter. We are at Smart Talk, WITF. Again, that phone number, 1-800-729-7532. I gave a brief description of Nathan Bedford Forrest, but he was much more than just my brief description. How would you describe Nathan Bedford Forrest?
I think his life is a really instructional one for understanding both the historical moment leading up to the Civil War and then in the aftermath of it as well. So Forrest was born in 1821, and his life really sort of moves west along with the frontier. So as I was digging into Forrest's life, you start to understand the consequence of things like the Trail of Tears as the Deep South sort of starts to open up to what would become plantations and the massive movement of enslaved people into the Deep South to work the cotton there. Forrest, of course, makes his fortune in that slave trade, working as a slave trader in Memphis. He then enlists in the Civil War to defend the right to enslave those men and women. And he's so rich that he finances his own cavalry troop. After the war, like you said, he becomes the first Grand Wizard of the Klan. He also operates a plantation using convict leasing, a practice known as slavery by another name. So in all these moments of his life, he's really bound up in these really extractive and violent ways that race has been used to enrich white people. So he has a very revealing life, but he also has a very horrifying one, I'd say.
You literally did stumble. Now, by literally, I don't mean you fell over it, but you came upon Forrest in Selma, Alabama. Tell us about how that happened, that incident.
That's right. So like you said, I'm a Lancaster native, and I moved to Alabama in 2013. And at that moment, there were a lot of 50th anniversaries of moments from the civil rights movement happening. So I moved to Tuscaloosa, Alabama, just as the 50th anniversary of Governor George Wallace's infamous stand in the schoolhouse door, his stand against the integration of the University of Alabama. So I'm really trying to make sense of my new home by looking at its connections to the civil rights movement. So on the 50th anniversary of Bloody Sunday, that's the attack by Alabama law enforcement on nonviolent demonstrators, and Selma's Edmund Pettus Bridge, the late John Lewis at the front of the line. 50 years later, President Obama is in Selma to commemorate the anniversary and to cross over the bridge in remembrance. And 40,000 other people show up with him. And so when I arrive in Selma for this anniversary, the town is just sort of overrun with people, and parking is a nightmare. And so I think, oh, I know, there's a cemetery not far from downtown. I can, and like a lot of Southern towns, this is a pretty sprawling cemetery, mausoleums, Spanish moss, very sort of cliched Southern tropes, but it has its own system of roads too. So I think, all right, I'll stash my car there and I'll walk down to the bridge for this anniversary. But as soon as I pull in, I start seeing these signs saying Confederate Memorial Circle closed for maintenance, no trespassing. And that's sort of catnip for a reporter, So I get out of my car and I wander over and I meet this group who's out that day, who calls themselves the Friends of Forrest. And I learn that really for the better part of the last two decades, they'd been fighting about this monument of Forrest that they had put up. And, given his biography that we've talked about, putting up a monument of Forrest anywhere is going to be controversial. But to do it in Selma, particularly given its civil rights history, was incredibly controversial. And I learned that they did it in the same week that the city's first black mayor was elected. So it just an enormously controversial thing. And the dissonance of meeting this group of Confederates on a day of the civil rights anniversary really just threw me for a loop. And like you say, I just sort of stumbled down this rabbit hole then of Forrest's life and what it means to put up a monument to him. And so those are the questions that the book is really wrestling with.
Now, this was right after the murder of 9 African-American church parishioners in Charleston, South Carolina, when the nation was looking at a lot of Confederate monuments, the Confederate flag, and what we were going to do with those in places across the country. Something that, and I want to read this from your book, The Lost Cause. You talk a lot about the lost cause. And we heard more about the lost cause after the Charleston murders as well. But I found this to be one of the best definitions of those who subscribe to the lost cause that I've found. You write that by emphasizing the valor of the soldier, the tragedy of his death, white Southerners sidestepped the thornier questions of slavery and white supremacy as the Confederacy's raison d'etre. So I just think that's a great definition of the lost cause. Talk about how Forrest became for you like that definition of the lost cause.
Yeah, so Forrest is a really interesting figure, and you can contrast him to someone like Robert E. Lee, who is, you know, the Lee family, one of the first families of Virginia. Lee is the kind of embodiment of a Southern gentleman, goes to West Point. Forrest is, you know, has a sort of hard scrabble upbringing. Of course, he became quite wealthy through the slave trade, but was born in sort of, you know, dirt floor poverty. Didn't go to West Point, hardly went to school at all. And so there's a sort of blue collar edge to his memory. And again, unlike Forrest, or I'm sorry, unlike Lee, who, you know, is leading the Army of Northern Virginia, is president in places like Gettysburg, Forrest is fighting in lesser battles off in the Western frontiers. So and even though he displayed a sort of natural military genius that his admirers like to talk about, he wasn't really given the same shot as Lee got in the war. And so folks who adhere to the lost cause, people who are avowing that the South will rise again, the folks who want a sort of Monday morning quarterback, the Civil War, point to Forrest as sort of what could have been. If only Forrest had been given his proper shot, well, then maybe the South would have won. You know, Jefferson Davis, the president of the Confederacy, is even has to account for this at Forrest's funeral, saying, you know, I didn't see it or I saw it too late, meaning Forrest's military genius. So Forrest is seen as this figure for lost causers as a, you know, the what could have been. But also by not talking about all of these ways that he is implicated in things like the slave trade, in convict leasing, the Ku Klux Klan, all of the sort of consequences and initiating incidents of the war, they want to focus on his military genius and not talk about these other things, which is a stock and trade of the lost cause, to emphasize, like I said, the soldier, but not, you know, the real consequences of the Civil War.
Monuments to Confederates or symbols of the Confederacy mean a lot to African Americans even today. What about Forrest? What do African Americans think about Forrest? Because there's more to him, as you've just described, than just being a military leader in the Confederacy.
He's reviled. I mean, in no uncertain terms, African American activists who I've talked to, you know, compare putting up a statue to Forrest to putting up a statue to Nazis in Germany. I mean, he is just that that abhorred, and I would say rightly so. I mean, his defenders or his apologists, like I said, want to talk about his military genius, but I that just can't outweigh the you know, manifold ways that he is implicated in really the darkest sins of America's past.
Let's talk about the one of those military experiences of his, and that is Fort Pillow in Tennessee. Talk about that if you would.
Sure. So Fort Pillow is a pretty minor fort. It didn't really have much strategic importance. But in the spring of 1864, Forrest and his cavalry troop surround Fort Pillow, where a couple of Union troops are stationed there, including two U.S. colored troops, which is the name given to formerly enslaved people who had enlisted in the Union Army after the Emancipation Proclamation the year previously. And Confederates really hated the notion that the men that they had formerly enslaved were now taking up arms against them. And they had, you know, the Confederacy had passed laws basically to treat them as escaped slaves and not to even consider them soldiers. And so Forrest's men, they surround the fort, take it pretty easily. And as the Union soldiers, the U.S. color troops are surrendering, they're still being executed. And it's just a massacre. And it's mostly the U.S. color troops who are killed. If you look at letters from that Confederate soldiers sent, you know, it's saying they would run up to us and fall to their knees and we would shoot them down like dogs. Forrest, in his own report from the battle, wrote that, you know, the river was run red with blood, and said that he hoped that this would prove that black soldiers could not cope with Southerners, although of course he used a different word to refer to black soldiers. So, I mean, really just a racial massacre, pure and simple. He makes dark mark on his record there. He becomes an accused war criminal as well.
In the book, and you take kind of a unique journey here in that you look at four different places where there are monuments to Nathan Bedford Forrest. And there are battles today, if you will, or during the last 20 years over those monuments. You mentioned you stumbled upon the first one in Selma. What happened in Selma with that monument that was torn down but then replaced?
Right. So the statue initially goes up in October of 2000. And like I said, that's the same week that the city inaugurates its first black mayor. And so that kicks off a big fight, protesters, battles in City Hall. Eventually the statue is moved out to the cemetery, because it had originally gone up on city property. So it's moved to the Confederate section of the cemetery, but it still remains just a site of protest and controversy. And eventually in 2012, the statue is stolen. But that doesn't resolve anything. That only kicks up more fighting. Eventually a federal lawsuit about whether the Friends of Forrest would be able to replace the statue. They win that court case. And so by the time that I meet them in the spring of 2015, they were fresh off that win in court. They'd been deeded this land in the cemetery by the Selma City Council. And so, they sort of have their feathers up and are celebrating this win and getting ready to dedicate the statue. And they do so in May of 2015, just a couple of weeks before the Charleston 9 murders. And so what's I think really useful about monuments and what made me think that there could really be a book out of following battles about them is that they have this really interesting way of combining sort of past and present, or showing the ways that the past is still shaping so much about our present. So when you look at the battle of a monument like Forrest and Selma, it's a present day power struggle, but it's also drawing on the past and the different ways that we remember the past, the different ways that we think the past continues to, you know, have an influence on our present. So it's a really useful way for, you know, a journalist who's also a history buff to look at the ways that, you know, we never really do escape our past.
Murfreesboro, Tennessee. This is where Middle Tennessee State University is located. One story, and I just have to pass this along because I have to say that it just was shocking. I know that we're talking about 90 years ago, but you were shown a 1930s era yearbook from the university that had included paintings of a day in the life of a rural Tennessean that included a lynching. And it was done kind of like, I don't know, with a sense of humor, if you want to put it that way, that it was like a lighthearted kind of thing. But talk about what happened at Middle Tennessee and Murfreesboro.
That's right. So Middle Tennessee State has a long history of using Confederate imagery and symbols and imagery of Nathan Bedford Forrest in particular. And so in the aftermath of the Charleston 9 murders, students on campus started a protest movement to try and rename a building that was on campus and named after Forrest. But of course, I'm covering that present day. I'm campaign, but I'm also digging into the history of the school and asking questions about why they're using this kind of imagery. And there's a long history there. So like you say, the one of the earliest usages of, you know, Old South or sort of Confederate style imagery is from this 1930 yearbook that includes a Klan image of a Klan lynching. It's shocking, but like you say, it's sort of, it was the kind of the water that they swam in at the time, because if you look, there were lynchings taking place all over Tennessee throughout those years. One would take place the very next year, you know, in the next town over, after that yearbook is published. So, you know, I think that some critics want to say like, oh, they're just symbols. Oh, they're just images. You know, they don't mean much, but clearly they're a reflection of the attitudes, of the values, of the people who are using them and publishing them. And it makes it clear in no uncertain terms that this is, you know, this is, about controlling and hoarding power and opportunity and wealth for white people, and they will defend that violently and to the, you know, to the exclusion of the Black Americans around them.
We only have about 3 minutes left. Two other places that you visited, Nashville and Memphis. Memphis, where Forrest is buried. Let's talk a little bit more about Memphis, because this was one of the bigger battles, or at least the most elongated battles, over a monument to Forrest.
That's right. So in Memphis, there's a 30-foot bronze equestrian statue of Forrest, you know, commissioned by the city to be sculpted by a Parisian sculptor. And it goes up in 1905. And it's a big deal. I mean, it's so big a deal that they even disinterred Forrest and his wife from their graves in a cemetery to rebury them under the plaza of this statue. And so over the course of the 20th century, it's this both celebrated and revered symbol of the city, but increasingly one that comes under protest as well. And so there's a long battle about trying to remove this statue from the city in Memphis, from the city of Memphis. And eventually, in the winter of 2017, after a really hard-fought and determined grassroots effort to try and get this statue down, the city of Memphis finally finds a loophole in the laws protecting the sorts of Confederate monuments that litter the state. They find a loophole in that law and a way to get it down by selling the city park to a private owner, and that makes it thus, you know, outside of the laws protecting Confederate statues. And as soon as the bill of sale is signed, the statue is removed late at night. So there's this, you know, really dramatic moment of the statue coming off of its platform. So that's really the climax of the book there. And I think goes to show the ends to which people want to protect those statues and also the power that can be found in their removal.
The book is Down Along with That Devil's Bones. That devil is how one Union general referred to Nathan Bedford Forrest, a reckoning with monuments, memory, and the legacy of white supremacy. In the 60 seconds or so we have left, Connor, what's the takeaway? What do you want the reader to get from your book?
I hope that the reader gets a sense of, you know, the really deep wrong that these statues represent, but then an understanding that removing them is really only the start of the battle. There are, systems and policies that these statues are symbols of that take, you know, a lot of hard-fought work to remove and to forge a more equitable society. So looking at the statues and understanding the wrong that they represent is really important, but it's really just a starting point.
Connor Towne O'Neill, a native of Lancaster. The book is Down Along with That Devil's Bones. Thank you very much for being with us today.
My pleasure. Thank you, Scott.
I'm Scott Lamar. Have yourself a great day.